Hello, you're listening to Spoiler
Build.
Film.
Conversation.
Hooray!
And if you don't know, and you've only accidentally tuned in, please stay listening. Hello, I'm Richard Nicholas, and with me today are Abigail Bain
Hello.
and Anthony Evans.
Hola.
So, guys, once again, we are here to talk about a film in spoiler-filled details. And that film was picked by Anthony. It is the film The Court Jester from 1955, isn't it?
Or 1956, if you read what you believe. Or believe what you read, rather.
There's always a bit of contention with when a film is, because in Britain we get them later than the USA, and IMDb can choose either year to decide which date is correct. So it was in some year in the 50s, the mid-50s, shall we say.
Mid-50s. Let's say that, yes.
So, Anthony, seeing as it's your pick, please give us the details of said film.
Oh, yes, The Court Jester. Written and directed by Melvin Frank and Norman Panama, starring a lot of famous names such as Danny Kaye, Glynis Johns, Basil Rathbone, and Angela Lansbury. The film follows the exploits of an ex-circus entertainer come wandering minstrel named Hubert Hawkins, who becomes embroiled in a plot to overthrow a usurping ruler and replace him with the rightful heir, all whilst under the guise of a world-famous court jester.
Doesn't it
Indeed.
sound intriguing? We've watched it. Hopefully you have. If you haven't, we're going to give you the skinny. It's going to be spoiler filled, so bear that in
Go
mind.
watch it. Yeah, go watch it.
Yeah, and you don't even have to come back. Just watch films. That's what we're all about, watching films. Guys, right, Anthony, you picked it. Why did you pick
I
it?
did.
Why did you make us watch it?
Well, I watched it a long time ago. I wouldn't say childhood, we're talking like early teens maybe. And I just remember liking it, even though I thought, oh, this is an oldie film which is going to be boring and long. And over the years, it's kind of shied away in my mind, and all I can remember is kind of like major set pieces, but like those major set pieces were enough to stick in my mind. As I'm sure we'll discuss further on.
Yeah, there's one that comes to mind, and it'll come up. But Abby, what were your expectations when Anthony suggested this one to you?
I was really surprised because this doesn't look like a film anyone would think of.
Well, it was in the dustier corner of Anthony's mind.
It was. I shall take that as a compliment, I guess.
It does. I have a personal classification of films, which is Sunday.
Yeah.
Just any film that is on a Sunday when they're not expecting people to be looking for anything in particular, just something to look at that they haven't seen before.
Or, as I like to think of Sunday afternoon movies, spoiler-filled gold. That's what we're all about. If you watch it on a lazy Sunday, we're up for reviewing it.
There wasn't much more to it than that in my head because it isn't one of those films that you have strong feelings for based on a clip. It's too, one, inexplicable, two, quaint.
Sure. I think my reaction to it was just from a clip that Anthony sent us a link to, and it was just, "Ooh, this looks weird." And I looked it up a little bit and found out it was from the 50s. And I was like, "Ooh, yeah, that's good. We need something from deeper in the past." It's very easy to find movies in the 80s, 90s, and 70s that you fancy watching, but people they tend not to explore. And I think it's good to try cinema you don't usually. And the 50s, I've not seen that many. I've seen enough to be arrogant in my opinions on the matter, but it's not a very well explored era for me. And it was kind of quirky and I don't know, like you say, quaint, old fashioned in a kind of light hearted way. And I was interested and I thought, oh, knights. I like gags about knights. Sure. Let's go. And I didn't really know much more. I didn't know why Anthony picked it. I didn't think he'd even seen it before, but he said he did, so I believe him.
That was a very complex series of thoughts.
know. I'm trying to tame my brain. So let's get into the meat and two veg fit, to Is that a phrase? Let's get into the meat and two veg.
Sure.
Sure it is, Rich.
It is all spoiler filled.
I'm a coiner of phrases and a phraser of coins. And I, that's almost a reference to this film. Because it is about a jester who has a catchphrase. And his catchphrase is, I am Giacomo, which is weird because that's like a catalog brand of menswear. Like, is it not Giacomo?
I think you're thinking of... Yeah, no, it is. Just spelled differently.
Fat bloke's catalog for clothes.
Anyway, nice plug for Giacomo there.
Yeah, and I am a fat bloke, and I have once bought a thing from Giacomo, so if you want to send me any free clothes, feel free. Just get in touch with Film Bin... You'll figure it out if you're listening, Giacomo. But anyway, the main character... Oh, the title character is called Giacomo, and he has a catchphrase, and it is Giacomo... It's spelled differently. It's French or Italian. Italian is Italian. And it's Jester of Kings or King of Jesters and Jester of Kings. Is that, am I doing it right?
Yeah.
There was some reason I was segueing into the film. Oh, yeah. It's because I was procrastinating and not getting on with the podcast. Right, guys. The film. What happened? Tell me. Anyone.
Well, it kind of has a bit of a weak start compared to like the tale of the film. Where it's all, like, mayhem and tricks and whatnot. So, like, the beginning is kind of just setting up of all the plot.
We kind of open with a song, don't we, from a jester. We have yet to find out who they are. But the main character is singing to us the start of the tale, isn't he?
Oh, yeah. I forget about that.
And we're getting, you know, their usual credits. And it's kind of a weak song. This is a comedy, musical, period drama, farce, I guess. And essentially, it's the opener to get you, you know, start listening, watch the screen, you know, kind of thing. But you're going to say about the start of the plot itself.
Yeah, so I guess we start off by being introduced to, like, the, like, usurper king of... Is the country named? I can't seem to remember. Anyone remember?
Mock Britain. Not.
Mock Britain. Sure, anyway, the king of wherever has been usurped by this new guy. And I guess the plot is he's trying to marry off his daughter, who is played by Angela Lansbury, to the neighbouring king or knight or whatever, in order to kind of cement his rule in the country. But there is, like, the real heir, who is a baby with a special purple... birthmark.
Rather conveniently shaped like a lovely flower, so that it is truly unique and somewhat bizarre.
Indeed, and then there is plots going on against with a kind of Robin Hood band of merry men type group.
It is,
who want, yeah.
It is a legitimate knockoff of Robin Hood. But it's kind of Robin Hood meets Zorro, which is very applicable. They're kind of the Zorros of different worlds, like one of California and one of Britain, but he's called the Black Fox, which, you know, is kind of, well, Zorro wears black and is, you know, Zorro means fox, and he is like Robin Hood. His unique thing being that his merry band of men includes a lot of acrobatic, possibly midgets, possibly dwarfs, you know, small men. That's his thing, the Black Fox, in this film.
I don't think it's his specifically. I think they were enlisted by the main character. His name is Hubert, but he goes by Giacomo throughout most of the film, so it's hard to know what to call him.
I think I'd rather call him Hawkins, because I'm not sure I can say the name Hubert.
Hubert, okay.
In any way that doesn't make me go, Hubert.
Then from now on, we should call him Hawkins. Is everyone agreed?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, they were circus friends that they wanted to help him out, and then Black Fox was just like, I'm not sure I have a place for a dozen dwarves.
Of course he does.
So I'm afraid you're going to have to leave.
That doesn't happen, does it? Surely, like, I thought, like...
Yeah, he sends them back in.
Well, here's the thing. The way we get introduced to the Black Fox, who is this Robin Hood-like, mythical character of heroes and legends, he's in this, he's a legitimate man who saves lives and robs from the rich... And tries to get the king, the rightful king, baby on the throne and stuff. He is introduced to us in a musical number. It is a musical, fair enough. But a rather bizarre one that kind of sets the mad tone. Where he is singing to us. It's a weird little song. and he starts to multiply with little clever hidden choreographed dancers popping out in his clothes. And then there's like maybe three or four black foxes, isn't there? And they're all singing together and dancing. And then suddenly they somehow multiply again, but into tiny dwarves. Like they kind of halve into dwarves and dance even more. It's quite bizarre, guys.
It is. Yeah, I don't think that's the actual black fox. I think that's Hawkins in disguise.
Yeah. As, you don't remember that opening number at all, do you?
Wait, so I do. There's lots of men in
So either way, yeah, you've got it more or less right, except it's not the black fox. It's Hawkins in disguise. But then the black fox turns up and berates him for it.
Oh, okay. Because this is what I didn't understand. There's a point where Hawkins, who is fundamentally the main character, is thought to be the black fox. There's times where everyone thinks he is him, then he isn't, then the black fox is coming to the rescue, only he doesn't, and Hawkins sort of saves himself with the help of his dwarf friends. And there's this kind of weird thing about the black fox is never really in it that much.
No, I guess no. I guess he's just kind of like a throwaway Robin Hood kind of reference.
But he's useless because he doesn't actually help, but he's not the hero of the story.
Yeah.
Anyway, it's confusing because he splits up into many different versions of the same thing, and it's all trickery and disguise and weirdness. I mean, did anyone else get blown away by that opening sing-song bit?
Yeah, of course. It was amazing.
It was. It was good, right?
And the weird thing is,
going as well.
Yeah, and the weird thing was, that's like that wasn't one of the major set pieces I remember.
Oh, yeah.
From the film.
Yeah.
So what's to come is even better, guys. Wow.
But like you say, it's an intriguing enough plot. There's been some kind of dispute over the throne, and we're told that the baby that is somehow the king. I mean, there's an orphan baby with a birthmark, isn't it? So that's the good guy king. We don't really know the back history other than they said it's good and he's on the side of the poor, so that's good, right? And
they talk him up even though we don't see him much.
Yeah.
He does a really bad attempt on the king as well. He shoots one guy.
What, the baby?
No, sorry, the black fox. He does that thing at the start of the film where he shoots one of the king's party with a note threatening the king, and then doesn't kill the king. The king and the whole rest of his party just moves on.
Yeah, that was a missed opportunity if they really wanted to stop the king. It's less threats on arrows and more try executing him. He's right there. You could have got him.
Where did this baby come from anyway?
The throne room.
The throne?
Presumably there's some kind of... There is some kind of tragic backstory where the original king and queen and all that were murdered. And then...
Well, you'd assume. I mean, that's what would have to have happened.
To leave an orphan baby.
Because he said that he was a usurper and that he got the throne by a war. So,
okay. Often the way. I mean, that's how medieval stuff went down, isn't it? Just armies turned up, fought over it, and then whoever was alive said, I'm the king.
I'm the king.
Or maybe they'd have a different accent, because it was usually people who didn't live in England or wherever that became king.
Ah. Indeed. Anyway, back to the film.
Yeah, I mean, we're told who the good guys are, but it becomes obvious that they are where they're the ones to root for, the weird resistance. But the first goal is for our man Hawkins to take the baby, hidden in a special cart, to safety? What was the plan with that? I didn't really follow where they were going because it gets interrupted.
She's meant to be taking it.
We haven't introduced she. But
that would be another member of the Robin Hood gang, played by Glynis Johns, named Major Jean.
Major Jean. Wait,
who's also quite,
isn't she
quite
Captain Jean?
Might be. She's quite the capable woman.
Yes, she is both... I mean, she has a reputation as being like a kind of one of the lads, like responsible leader of many of them. So she isn't initially a sort of love interest. I mean, she is the love interest of the story, but she has a reputation for being an important member within the resistance. She's in no way some floozy.
Yeah, and she plays it quite straight for most of the film, I guess.
Yeah, you were going to say, Ab, she was part of the Hawkins duo that was taking the child somewhere.
Yeah, I think they were just meant to be taking it far away from the castle, basically as far as they could get. But then they get intercepted for different reasons.
Yeah, they're in disguise, aren't they? By guards, yeah. They're in disguise, and Hawkins is dressed as an old man. She's dressed as a wench, I guess, or the daughter of the old man. And that's where we have our first bit of, like, shtick that's, like, a bit comedy and a bit fun, isn't it?
I guess it's the usual kind of thing. When you have a film that you have, like, one star at the centre, you always have the kind of scene where he's dressed up as someone else or pretending to be someone else. I don't know, that's kind of a thing, another trope that seems to happen.
Well, Hawkins seems to be a man of many disguises because he plays a jester for the most part.
Indeed.
But it's a lot of I'm old and, oh, what's he saying there? And, oh, I'm like trying to confuse the guards by not understanding everything. And, like, they kind of... Captain Jean or whatever, Jean, we'll just call her Jean for now. She is joining in, and it's like a kind of three-way gag between the between her, him, and the guard that they're kind of annoying, and trying to avoid them searching too thoroughly on the barrel cart they have the baby hidden in, isn't it?
Yeah, it doesn't really amount to much.
No, because they carry on their ways, don't they? Really.
Hmm.
It's just so they could be recognised again later, more or less.
Oh, I suppose.
Yeah, what happens is they somehow are split up and one of them loses a wheel of a wagon. No, they end up staying the night and that's how they bump into Giacomo, isn't it?
Yes.
So they.
It happens really soon as well. This film really gets on with it.
Oh, yeah, that's the way to go, right?
We need to get the baby out of here. Okay, then. Du-du-du-du-du. Have a little kip. It's I, Giacomo, conk. You're Giacomo. Go.
Yeah, I mean, essentially, they just stay in, like, a damp hovel house thing. Even though there's a weird suspicious moment for me where it's only damp in one bit. There's, like, a bit of the roof is leaking. So they decide to sleep there, and they'll be like, oh, it's all damp, so we have to be really close and get together, man and woman, just hug close for warmth. And you're just going to go, what about the rest of that massive cottage you just came into? Like... It's not. It looks dry over there, right, guys? I mean, the baby looks fine. That's out of the damp.
I can't stay in offices, to be honest.
I don't know. I just think there's something up with our man Hawkins. I mean, he does... This is where the romantic element comes in. I mean, it's not particularly a romantic film, but Hawkins and Jean are together trying to sleep, but simultaneously talking about the events that are unfolding. And there's a bit of, like, weird... Hawkins is talking to her. She's telling her backstory a little bit, and he's somewhat ignoring it and just trying to kiss her and stuff. How did you guys interpret that kind of development? I thought it was kind of weird that he was just ignoring her and going on with it, even though, seemingly, they were both being nice to each other.
Well, yeah, you can see it's obviously been played for comedy, but it does come across as slightly creepy.
I wouldn't use such a strong word, just so much as he just doesn't care that she's just talking about her father and how she was raised to be like one of the boys and things, and he's just, yes, 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 like, and just trying to pursue their relationship.
A lot of this film is timeless, but that one bit in particular was very of its era, where you just make out with a lady if she's about to.
Yeah, the saucy 60s were on the horizon, so it was just starting to move towards the more carry-on world of filmmaking. But for all intensive purposes, this scene is to insert the real Giacomo, who is a jester, jester of kings, kings of jesters, whichever the phrase is, and he turns up. And he's like, oh, all right. And like, as you say, Ab, you put it so eloquently and briefly earlier, there's almost no need to elaborate. But they basically find out that he's going to be going to the... He's expected by the new king, the current tyrant. And they bonk him on the head and go, well, let's just dress up as him, pretend to be the jester that they've hired. And bish, bash, bosh, we get in there.
And we never see him again.
props. Just
yeah, I assume he's dead.
Yeah, that's what I assumed as well. Just, he's dead now.
Yeah, because the thing with Giacomo that we find out later is that he's also an assassin, as well as the most famous court jester ever. He's big in Europe, and he's come to muddy old wherever we are. And
yeah, he's also. So you think if he's still alive, if he was still alive, he'd come back and try and sort everything out.
Yeah.
So I guess, but they really don't mention it. It's like they totally drop it after that.
It's the sort of thing you kind of expect him to jump off like a massive tower and dive down into some straw and then suddenly stab someone with like a hidden blade and pull them into the hay and be like, ah, I've got my revenge. And then just rest in peace, fool, you know. But no, they didn't know about Assassin's Creed back then. So how could they have done that scene? But yeah, it's just, there's no repercussions to knocking out that guy and leaving him. But it's that's when the story's all about infiltrating the castle, get in the king and putting the baby back in. So it doesn't. They don't really have a concrete plan other than key to the passage.
No, it's something about getting they have to get the key to the passage, a certain passageway, so the Black Fox and all his gang can get up all up in the king's grill and get him out of there.
Yeah.
But, you know, being a farce and a musical, it gets more complicated and fun and insane. So, you know, plenty to talk about. But yes, basically, they split up. One takes the jest. Hawkins is now ipso facto Giacomo. He's playing him. He's kind of. He takes very well to the persona of a court jester. He's got an inbuilt ability to be witty and have circumstances be funny around him. So. He's a very, the original Giacomo didn't seem all that funny, to be honest.
No, but yeah, he seemed quite serious, the kind of hero type.
Yeah, well, he's an assassin, so maybe he's off work. He doesn't have to be larking about when he's going for a rest. But yeah, the wheel falls off a wagon, the woman is separate and gets caught. They all end up at the castle anyway. That's kind of what happens, isn't it?
Yeah. And then I guess the kind of main thread from there is Giacomo being confused between who is rebel in disguise on his side and who are the people who are looking for Giacomo the assassin, who he doesn't realize he is at the moment.
Yeah, essentially they have a coded whistle or something to signify I am the agent on the inside. And when that happens, Basil Rathbone, who is in fact is the bad guy, who's Basil Rathbone is essentially hoping to manipulate the king, or is it assassinate the king or something? What's the thing?
Yeah, he doesn't want the king's plans of marrying his daughter off to work because he thinks that would lose him power.
Yeah, think of him as a Jafar from Aladdin type character, and he's expecting Giacomo to come. Knowing he's a double agent and assassin, and obviously he gets a double agent for the good guys, but there is that misunderstanding. The correct agent for the Black Fox group is not understood to be... basically, Hawkins thinks Basil Rathbone's character is the man on the inside, when in fact, he is not.
This is made even more complicated when Giacomo is hypnotized by a witch.
Yes, it is.
Yes, this is a weird little plot point, isn't it? It's just like the princess Angela Lansbury plays, I forget her name, her maid is a witch, and she's constantly threatening her with pain of death if she doesn't get her marriage annulled or something.
I want to say,
stops the marriage going through.
I want to say her name is Giselda or something.
Gwendolyn?
Gwendolyn. Nothing like Gwendolyn. What I said. But you're right. In this one, the princess is a sort of bad guy because she's a bit selfish. And I mean, initially, she doesn't want to marry whoever her dad says for political reasons. That should be the sort of story that you should be saved from, like Robin Hood would do, right? But because she's a bit more mean about it by making, bullying her witch handmaiden to make sure that she doesn't have to marry some idiot that the king has picked, she's not likable and therefore is a semi-bad guy. It's unusual for a film to take that kind of approach.
Yeah. Yeah, I know what you mean. It's like, it's sad to say, but like in a film made this long ago, if you have a woman lead, they're usually just there to be the romantic, you know, the romantic counterpoint. But here they like really play with it, and they have this like second odd princess character. I don't really know what to make with her, really.
Yeah, I mean, Angela Lansbury, who's probably known best as, I want to say Agatha Christie, but I don't mean Agatha. Yeah, Jessica Fletcher, yes, and also I guess in Bedknobs and Broomsticks, and it's the Bedknobs and Broomsticks connection that I think I was like, ah, Angela Lansbury's in it. Angela Lansbury's in Bedknobs and Broomsticks. I see why Anthony has picked it. That's one of his favourite things. So she, like, I underlined her when I spotted she was in it. Is that a reason, perhaps, why you picked this, Anthony? Is because Angela?
It wasn't, actually. I totally forgot that she was in it. I remember that Glynis Johns was in it, and she's in Mary Poppins, which is kind of a counterpoint to Bedknobs and Broomsticks. But no, I totally forgot that Angela Lansbury was in it.
Oh, well.
I know.
But getting back to the story, I guess, she is sort of a bad guy character, but you should then feel sorry for the handmaiden who's a witch, but she is also a bad guy in a way, because she's kind of a poisoner and a manipulator, but then they don't really have a full comeuppance. They don't really, I mean, you know, it kind of, at the end, nothing really happens to punish them.
Yeah, I guess it's because, like you say, like, they're... The thing that they're getting after, you know, the audience can get behind, because it's like, you know, you don't want to see anyone married off to anyone they don't want to. I totally forgot where I was going with this point.
Trying to explain why someone who is essentially getting married off when they don't want to, which is a perfectly acceptable thing for a modern audience to dislike, is why are they the bad guys then? If that's something, if they're trying to stop them, you know, that if Angela Lansbury doesn't want to be married off, we should be rooting for her. And yet,
I think it's one of those things where they're trying to say that everyone in the palace is the bad guy.
I guess so.
And that they have to be replaced by a baby.
Yeah.
And then, you know, they're not going to fight over who gets to be the regent. No! That won't happen.
A baby's the perfect candidate for the throne. All those hard decisions to make about land and taxes. Well, anyway, they're thrown in to confuse matters further. And, like you say, basically, the princess forces her witch handmaiden to meddle with the jester, or basically stop her marrying this Griswold chap who the king has fancied as being a good political alliance because he's rich or something. Abby, the name Griswold must have set off some trigger for you and me. Would you care to?
Because of Yogscast on the internet, and they have a thing about. I want to do it, but it'll hurt me and the listener.
Go on.
They have a recurring motif character of Professor Griswold!
Yeah, and they say the name a lot, and all the time I'm thinking of Yogscast and going, oh, Professor Griswold. But I just bring it up to needlessly reference some other culture. So, back to the plot. Griswold is not in it yet, but the witch is now manipulating the newly arrived on the scene, Giacomo, into thinking that he is in love with the princess, and therefore the princess will marry Giacomo. And basically, the witch is tricking the princess as well, and telling her lies and stuff.
That's why she's a witch, I guess.
But she basically says, you're, oh, look out the window now. This stupid court jester man, he is your true love. He'll be right in and sweep you off your feet. And then she has to set about making that happen by weirdly hypnotising Giacomo into thinking he is there as some kind of star-crossed lover for her, the princess, that is. So they throw that in, because, you know, double agents and confusion and rebellion is not, you know, going to get tricky enough.
Yeah, so I guess it's just like the convergence of all these... like plot threads just like coming together and wrapping themselves around the court jester, which like makes for like all of the entertainment of the film, shall we say.
And it means there's a lot of swinging on a rope between many windows and talking to the various people who live in the castle from Basil Rathbone's weird character.
I particularly liked how exciting it looked when he was swinging, because to me it looked quite real and quite scary.
Yeah, it wasn't too bad. I mean, this is an old-fashioned film, so at times the matte paintings are a little bit painty-y. That's not a word. But, you know, it's obvious that at times when they're on you know it's a set, and you can see that it's matte paintings, but it is kind of... There is an element of nice quality to the look of it. I would agree with you.
Oh, yeah, and it was... By that point, it was totally fine that you suspend your disbelief that he would be able to swing from one window to the other without actually going up at any point.
Yeah, it's a daring and fun kind of scene, you know, and it's for families, and you're meant to be having a laugh anyway, so no one's taking it too seriously. And it was quite effective and funny. Like, basically, once he's hypnotized, there's a lot of gags involving the clicking. Like, once I click, you're out of the spell and whatnot, and when I click again, you're back under. So there's lots of this weird clicking making people, making Giacomo, or rather Hawkins as Giacomo, come out of character as this hero who's going to marry the princess and himself. Like, so they kind of it's a bit stupid at first, but it works in other scenes a little bit better. What do you guys make of the clicking hypnosis gag?
I think it's done better on later on. Yeah. There's there's a second
in the fight
wave
scene
of that. Yeah, which is better. But you know, it's fine. It's harmless enough.
And it helps with Hawkins is a bit afraid at times. So when he's clicked into the persona he's been told he should be, which is the hero rescuing the princess, he's a little bit more confident, and he's partly setting up plans with Rathbone, a bit confused as to what's going on, being told he needs to assassinate and poison people, and also he's being told you need to seduce the princess and save her, and there's just a lot of this and toing and froing between rooms, as we mentioned on the rope swingy window thing, and then he shoved Giacomo's back in the corridors to his actual agenda.
This film is so hard to explain.
Yeah. But he's then talking to the undercover wench that is Jean, and she's just kind of perplexed and baffled as to what's going on slightly, but rolls with it. And they've got a baby to hide now in a basket. It's quite the plot.
Yeah, it's this is almost no need really kind of explaining it. It just kind of ruins it. I think we should probably just point out the rest of the stuff that sticks out to us. Yeah. Well, either way, there's a lot of mayhem going on. Yeah.
We've tried to grapple with it, but it's too unkempt.
For every single bit you try and explain, you have to explain this whole other chunk that becomes embroiled with it later on.
Yeah, and there's lots of switcheroos and things, and people find out at different times that other people are behind other things. We won't get into it, but I think that the major scene that we need to talk about that happens next is when the king wants to see Giacomo do his stuff and be the court jester and entertain them as a jester should, and sing and dance and be a fool. There's a scene where you know it calls for more music, and basically it's Hawkins doing his best impression of a jester while simultaneously trying to stop them paying attention to a basket that has the baby in that's so significant, isn't it?
Yes. Also, while the king is perving over Jean a lot.
Yeah.
In this film.
So, I mean, what do you guys make of that scene? It's quite it's one of the centre comedy scenes, I think. What do you guys make of it?
Yeah, it was fine. I mean, Danny Kaye is, you know, he's quite the capable actor if you're watching this film. You know, he can switch between, like, action, heroic, and comedy, and pathetic quite easily. Mm. And you know, he makes great use of it in this scene as well.
It was so complicated as well. He has to do all the song and dance numbers, but at the same time, the witch is killing the people that he was supposed to kill for Basil Rathbone. And then when that happens, Hawkins is surprised, but he has to play up that he's not surprised and that was supposed to happen.
I feel sorry for the three dudes who got poisoned, because they're the only few proper deaths. I mean, most people are dispatched by elaborate catapult. So there's not that much death, but there's three dudes who we don't know very much. They're just, you know, powerful underlings of the king, and they're murdered because, you know, baddies. And it is just a bit, oh, do they have to die? You know?
Yeah, everyone else just gets wet. That's not fair.
But like you say, it is this, there's a lot of stuff Giacomo has to do, and it's stop the baby being found and do a dance and song number and entertain everyone. He sort of muddles his way through, and that's what's entertaining and keeps everyone thinking he's genuinely a jester. It's quite a well-crafted scene, and it's got a lot going on,
yeah.
I think.
Yeah, and he always keeps this like sense of urgency, the kind of visceral. You know what I mean? Just kind of keeps the audience on their edge through his performance.
Like at any point, this could all go sideways and he could be caught or they could be outed and stuff. And that does happen. I mean, there comes a point where non-Professor Griswold turns up and, you know, he's a well-to-do political big wig and he turns up on the scene and is going to be, you know, they're there to confirm the marriage of the princess and Griswold. And then
the princess is like, no way, man!
Yeah, and meanwhile, Giacomo has to sit there at the foot of the king, being kicked by both of them into singing, which is kind of a slightly weird but funny gag where he's just prompted to sing ad-libbed all the time and kicked to shut up. But it's just kind of the peak of the... Now, listen here, I'm not marrying him. I'm in love with Giacomo. What do you mean you're in love with Giacomo? Shut up, woman. I'm trying to get away with it. You know. it comes to a head at this point, and basically everyone is found out, more or less. And Giacomo is basically outed as some kind of criminal, possibly the Black Fox, possibly not. It's hard to say at this point. But he basically is thrown in the dungeon, right? As they decide what's going to happen.
Yeah, well, essentially, yeah. Until they decide that they are going to make him a knight in order for him to then duel Griswold and die in the end.
It's the best / dumbest idea I've ever heard.
Well, so then they put him through like a montage then of comedic knight training.
Yeah. I think
it was quite fun.
I think it was, I mean, the training was fun, but the reason why they like, oh, we'll make him a knight and make him fight Griswold, because Griswold can't challenge a peasant or a commoner to a duel, right? But it's kind of in everyone except Hawkins' benefit that they do this, because the princess is like, oh, he'll kill Griswold and then I'll have to marry him. And Griswold's like, I'll just kill this dude and it'll be fine. And the king's like, yes, this will be an apt way to get rid of the Black Fox. And Rathbone's thinking the same. It's like, good, he'll die and no problem. And it's all kind of, everyone will benefit from this. And, you know, even in a way, Hawkins, if he can man up, will benefit if he wins. So that's kind of why it happens. But yeah, you're right. There is a comedy bit where they kind of rush him through the training. I thought it was quite funny and effective.
Yeah, me too. I like that little montage.
Although they did do the marching around the Great Hall.
Yeah.
Forever.
The ending ceremony of the knighting went on a bit long. Like, it was suitably absurd enough to be, like, to be passable, but, you know, it was a lot of just stomping around really fast.
Yeah, because you go from a fairly good, witty, fast-paced gag of chuck him over the wall, if he needs to climb a wall, just throw him over the wall, he needs to fight a wild boar, it's a tiny pig, he's fine. The one I liked was, they had to, like, he had to hunt a bird or something. They hand him a bow and arrow, and then they literally just chuck a like pheasant with like an arrow already through it on the ground straight away. Yeah. It was just kind of, that was funny. And then the weird marching, choreographed, stamping dance they do with the knights is just, it's just baffling. It's just a really weird,
it's like,
change.
It's quite entertaining at first when they're all crisscrossing and it's like, oh, this looks pretty on the eyes, and you see him doing his stuff like he doesn't know what to do.
And he keeps being caught up in the marching and stuff, and
And like the ridiculous fast marching at the end is really kind of absurd, but yeah, it's kind of the joke is too big.
It's just a bit like, come on, guys. It's not. I mean, a little bit of that would have been funny, but now it's just like Abby said. It goes on for a while. Like they milk that a bit too long. But they move on to other comedy, though. They like, you know, okay, it's time for the comedy night duel where the big burly Griswold is ready to murder this guy, and our reluctant Hawkins is putting on his suit, and there's all kinds of clumsy shenanigans stuck on.
Yeah,
hooks
this
and...
is like when all the wordplay comes out, isn't it?
Oh yeah. Does that happen before or after his costume is struck by lightning and therefore magnetized?
We'll say at the same time.
Yeah, why not? But it's kind of it links back in a way to Mr. Nanny, which has weird electric equals magnets logic, which we've already talked about in a previous spoiler filled. But it's just this idea that if you electrify metal, it will become a magnet. Who made that up?
Well, no, that is a thing. I mean, electromagnets are a thing. You pass like electricity through metal, and it becomes magnetized.
Yeah, but you need a coil, and you need to plan it a lot more.
Just striking some metal with lightning isn't going to make it magnetized.
But wah, 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 it makes his helmet stick to his hand, and they makes the knights stick together and stuff. Lol. But
and it is quite well done. But like trying to explain like comedy like that just comes off as a bit weird, doesn't it?
It was a bit.
Weird. Yeah, it loses a couple of science points there. But I guess the gag was worth it in the
end. If you think so. But the wordplay we could talk about. If you want to talk about the vessel with the pestle, the flagon with the dragon, the various other vessels with various other puns and connections. Wait, what's the thing? It's the vessel. Oh, does anyone want to join in the comedy here? It's the vessel with the pestle that is poisoned. And
the poison's in the vessel with the pestle. The
brew that is true is...
No. It's something...
I would actually do
something,
it again.
Something has the brew that is true. The chalice from the palace
has the brew that is true. And the vessel with the pestle has the poison that is in the flagon with the dragon. What?
Yeah, the chalice from the palace gets broken, so instead it has the flagon with the dragon. And then the poison isn't in the vessel with the pestle anymore, it's in the flagon with the dragon.
The flagon in the dragon, because there's no vessel with a pestle. No, there is a vessel with a pestle, in a poison, what?
And that's the film, people.
they play on this thing of, like, there being multiple... I want to think of another... Grails that have... One of them has poison in... And basically, they spend a long time, with people trying to remember which is the correct one. And basically, Hawkins trying not to poison himself. And it's kind of an effective gag, but it's very weird to hear people go vessel with a pestle over and over again.
Yeah, but entertaining and funny. I think the thing that got me about that, though, is just the kind of, like, anticlimactic kind of punchline, where it's just like, oh, no, we're not drinking anymore.
Yeah, it didn't...
It's like, oh, you're just going to drop that.
Yeah, and the way he does win the fight, because, you know, he has to, he's the hero, is he just gets a bit lucky, and, like, when Griswold manages to mace his shield, he kind of gets yanked off of his horse like an idiot and just loses, and it's like, oh, you lose then. Oh, really? A bit of cowardice and a lucky blow gone wrong? Like, and that's it? No heroics, no, you know, just kind of... Oh, Griswold's rubbish after a bit of horseplay.
Yeah.
But that's not the conclusion. That's not the big fight. The big fight comes at the end. What happens between Griswold losing? And he basically shows him mercy. Because Hawkins or... Yeah, it's Hawkins, but he's playing a jester. Because the jester has won, he decides to spare Griswold because he's a goodie. And then what happens?
Is it Basil Rathbone just kind of like... like spills the beans.
Yeah, he basically goes. He's the Black Fox. This can't happen.
Yeah,
and then like
and then the real Black Fox and all the troop turn up in through the secret passage, which needed the key, which is I'm sure been concluded at some point.
Yeah, there were so many bits that you had to keep track of. It's like there was a key. Yeah, how did that turn out again? Oh, someone got it back today. Oh yeah, that's it. Jean has a bit of comedy with the king earlier on, where she's being called in to be the king's lady of the street, knight, whatever the polite term for prostitute is. And she does a little bit of clever getting out of it while simultaneously getting the key. I think it involves her pretending that there's a family disease that the king could catch that she has. And ha ha ha, there's a woman being funny, good job. Like, you know.
I have never heard the word wench said with so much pleasure as in this film.
That's the medieval times, though, I think. There's something much more buxom and enjoyable about the word wench than there is... You just picture someone like with maybe a flagon with a dragon swigging some ale and saying wench and pulling some buxom lady closer. It's good. It's a nicer word than any of the other words for the type of work that those women do.
What are you doing?
I don't know. It's pretty. I don't want to be insensitive to women or prostitutes, but it came up.
Indeed.
Yeah. So the big climax is basically, oh, everything's kicking off, and there's a big fight, and it's back in the cool set hall that I'm sure I've seen in another film. They have like an interior of a castle that looks like every other interior of every medieval castle.
Maybe it is like a huge set. It's like likely they might have kept it around for other things.
Yeah, and basically all of the little dudes are snuck in. All the Black Fox or Hawkins men come in with ropes and swing down and rescue people. And they all really efficiently beat up all of the guards. All these like small dudes just lay the living. You know, what's it called, into the guards, right? I mean, really, really batter them, and there's unrelenting just failure from the part of the regular-sized men to do anything but yeah. be punched in the face.
And then the dwarfs form a kind of conveyor belt up the stairs with their legs,
yeah,
where they ship off all the knocked-out guards into a catapult and throw them over the castle walls.
That was the moment that just made me go, I've gone mad.
That's the moment in the film which made me go, it's all been worth it just for this scene. Just for all this setup.
Yeah, I mean, that's what we were foreshadowing to as one of the main set pieces, that you just go, oh my goodness, what am I watching? It's because there's no need. There is no need. They've already beat up all the guards, but they're just like, okay, they're also, you know, acrobat dwarfs from the circus, so they will just lie down across the stairs and along the floor and pass these weird mannequin-looking guards along in a path to the catapult, because... that makes sense. They're all knocked out. Let's catapult them out over the castle walls into the sea. Yeah, you just kind of go, I guess that'll do for an epic ending. What?
It's certainly memorable.
It is. It's the standout scene. I don't know if it's sort of a bit... I don't know if it's my modern sensibilities, but it feels just a bit wrong that all of these dwarfs are the weird... It's good that they're the heroes. They're successful. They're not belittled in any way. I don't know if I should use the word belittled, but you know what I'm saying. Like, they're the heroes, but it is, like, is this exploitation? Should we be feeling bad about the 1950s not understanding what's okay?
No, I guess not. It is slightly addressed, like, at the beginning, where it's like they are circus performers and then they're turned away, but now they're given the chance to kind of shine.
Yeah, I mean, the comedy is not, ha-ha, they're small. It's more, ha-ha, isn't this mad? Like,
yeah, exactly. The comedy doesn't come from them being small. It comes from just the madness of all the things that are going on.
Yeah. And while various guards are being slowly passed by foot to the catapult, we have the final fight scene between Basil Rathbone character... between Basil Rathbone's character and... Giacomo, they're having a fight, and this is where the clicking comes back into play, as you mentioned, Anthony.
Yeah, I think this scene is really good. So, Giacomo is hypnotized again into thinking he is an amazing sword fighter, and he goes to fight Basil Rathbone, and he's amazing. But any time there is a click, he falls back into the pathetic guy who doesn't know how to use a sword. And just swings it about, hoping that something will happen.
And I read that Basil Rathbone is actually was actually an extremely good fencer, and that's the only thing that stopped him being killed in this movie because Danny Kaye knew nothing and was just swinging his sword around like a madman.
Yeah, so.
But he does have some impressive moves. I think his performance in this scene is just brilliant. How he like changes between like the confident sword player and then I think the way he just swings the sword around just captures exactly like how he feels.
Yeah, and it works well on because they're on multiple levels of like kind of rooftops and the top of the castle area. There's like they slide down banisters and they muck around inside and things, and it is really effective. And like you say, Ab, like Basil Rathbone is legitimately partially at least trained sword fighter, and I think he was in like one of the old Zorro films as the bad guy. So there's a bit of swordplay in that, and so he can be relied upon. Whereas the creativity comes from the choreographing of it all, really. And it does really work. I thought it was like a really funny gag and like an effective, exciting climax. And
it's a nice turn on the kind of classic sword fight between the hero and the villain at the end.
Yeah, exactly. You wouldn't want it, you know, it's a comedy and it's meant to be fun. And wouldn't you know, Basil Rathbone ends up in the catapult as well, thrown into the sea.
Oh no! Those other guys had to die.
poor guys.
And then the film wraps up really, really quickly,
doesn't it? Just
sort of. I suppose like Griswold returns like with his army, but then they just kind of like flash the baby's bum to everyone, and everyone's happy enough.
Yeah.
Yeah. What happens to Angela Lansbury?
She's just not royalty anymore, so it doesn't matter who she marries.
Huh.
But nothing happens. They just literally go, don't fight Griswold. Look, baby's bum. And like you say, everyone just goes, oh, it's the true king, because it has the weird flower mark on his bum.
Oh, wait. No, I do remember. Like, at the end, Angela Lansbury and Griswold have been, like enemies. They sort of, there's a kind of bit at the end where it sort of seems like, oh, maybe they might fall for each other. Remember?
No.
Yeah, she's mean and horrible. He's mean and horrible.
Yeah, but it's so rushed. Like, the ending is really rushed, just like, okay, and now, like, happy ending, everyone's happy, let's do the last song, blah, 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 blah. So I guess it's easy to have missed in that quick ending.
It's just that thing of, the king doesn't even get, like, I mean, presumably he murdered the child's parents or caused it, and he gets nothing other than to go, no, I guess I'm not king anymore, seeing as you brought a baby here. Like, fair enough. Yeah, I mean, he's lost his arms.
Joined in with the end song.
Yeah,
I guess you want to be. You want to suck up at that point when you're no longer, you know, the king. You're like, oh, I'll just join in with a happy song. We link it to the start again. It's the jester-y court jester. Blah 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 blah. Happy endings. You know, that was my rendition, by the way.
This was wonderful.
Like you say, it wraps up pretty quickly, and we're left going, what on earth was that? And it was the court jester.
We're left to catch our breath.
Exactly, yeah. It is a strange one. I feel glad I watched it. I can't fully endorse it as a hit, but I certainly laughed at it, intentionally and unintentionally at times.
It's got enough humor. It's got enough funny set pieces.
It's got some
good actors.
Yeah, good actors. Yeah.
Full of energy. Which, you know, a lot more energy than I was expecting. Well, you just think that, don't you? Any film that's, like, more than 50 years old, from the black and white era, you just think, you know, it's slow and dull. But no, there was a lot of energy in this film, especially from Danny Kaye himself.
And colour. It was in colour as well.
It was. Sorry, black and white was just a reference.
Yeah, I didn't want to imply that's all. Because they have some quite bold, striking colours that I think are probably fairly representative of medieval times. If you're rich, you want the colours to tell people you're rich. So I did like the aesthetic of it. It was very bold.
Yes.
Anthony, speculative question.
Okay.
Why do you think they wore leggings?
Just in the past.
In the day?
I don't know.
Warm, easy to make. You know, not complicated, is it?
Well, I don't know. I'd think a pair of trousers would be
easier.
Less complicated and easier than a. Maybe that's it. Maybe they just wanted to show off the packages.
Yes, true.
It's a weird choice.
There was a reason
choice.
That Henry VIII had extremely specific codpieces.
Indeed.
There's a lot of syphilis to cover up for him, though. Anywho. So, you know, may as well, I mean, you kind of did a lot of summing up yourself there, aren't you? Are there any other things you want to say in conclusion? And we'll try and think of a rating system as well, as we usually do.
No, I kind of summed it up there, didn't I? Yeah, it's a good film. It's not perfect. Like, the beginning drags a bit where it's just all plot. And some of the stuff is a little too absurd sometimes, but entertaining enough all the way throughout.
Yeah.
So just a big, charming thumbs up from me, I suppose.
Good. Can we think of a rating system, like famous clowns or entertainers? I don't know.
I think if you broaden it out to entertainers in general,
yeah,
you might get...
So, an entertainer. You can think about it if you like, Anthony, and I'll ask you again. But
I'll say someone kind of like Bruce Forsyth.
I was thinking the same thing.
Well, you know, he's from a different era.
Yes.
But you know, some of the stuff he has come up with has been quite funny. Maybe not anymore. But that's why he belongs back in the 50s.
And then there are some jokes that just work.
Yeah.
So every now and again,
and he still has his like his flair and his charm.
He does. He has flair, charm, catchphrases are galore. I mean, the man has a reputation as being like a kind of like legendary British figure of light entertainment. So
yeah, and it's something you wouldn't set out to watch, but would be, you know, rather entertained watching it, you know what
yeah.
I mean?
If the Price is Right's on, and Brucey's doing his shtick with the audience, yeah, sure, maybe I'll catch the Price is Right, or that stupid playing cards thing, or Strictly Come Dancing, or... And he's done a lot of stuff, as Bruce Forsyth, and
yes.
A lot of people like him, and I think a lot of people would like this film. So I think that's apt to compare it to Brucey. So,
thank you.
Do you have any final thoughts, Abby?
More or less what Anthony was saying there, that it is just, it's one of those welcome things where you're not in the mood for anything in particular, you're skipping through a challenge, you go, oh, Court Jester. Yeah, go on then.
Well, most people wouldn't be like, oh, Court Jester, and realise what it is. They would just flick it on, and it would be at a moment where some dwarfs are doing some odd choreographed fighting or dancing, and they'd be like, what is this? And then they suck it in, hopefully. But I get what you're saying.
And I probably would watch it again eventually.
Sure.
Just sort of... I think I'll get to that point where I'll be remembering the film and I'll go, that can't be right, can it?
No.
You must be remembering that wrong. And I'll watch it again and go, no, I was right. Mental.
Do you have an entertainer that the film is in our ratings?
I don't know. Bruce Forsyth is so apt.
Yes, isn't it?
I'm trying to think.
It's Dale Winton.
Bruce is the one. We just nailed it. It's Bruce Forsyth.
It's the Bruce Forsyth of... What's weird is for Americans and stuff, they probably won't know who that is. But for the British, Bruce Forsyth is far more famous than the Court Jester. It's kind of an odd thing, really. I don't think the Court Jester is that well known. I don't think it did that well at the time. I think it panned in the box office, you know.
Yes, it did.
Yeah, it did.
A bit unfairly, I think. I mean, what else would there be on? A bunch of moody noir films. Who wants to watch those?
I suspect it was a little bit ahead of its time.
Or behind with the times.
No, because...
It's a bit of a panto,
isn't it?
Well,
we already said that it had progressive women.
It did. The two female characters in it are quite progressive, because one is a hero and essentially not to be treated like some floozy. She's, you know, she's confident and gets things done. And the other woman has an interesting plight that's a bit different from the usual princess in a castle. So it is ahead of its time in many ways. Maybe not with the dwarf stuff, but no, it's legitimately full of satire, so I like it for that. It really is full of jokes and gags, and it's always trying to make you laugh, so that's a thumbs up for that, I think. I think it was more or less good. I think overall I liked it. There are problems with it. It is a little bit dated and strange and stuff, but that's okay. It's certainly novel, and most people are doing a good job. They're not. It's not like phoned in particularly. I don't think.
Not at all.
The actors anyway. And if I was to try and think of another entertainer, that it is like maybe just like Punch from Punch and Judy. In a way, it's not for everyone. Admittedly, Punch from Punch and Judy is a lot more violent and disturbing than this film is, despite having some interesting choreographed sword fights. But it's got a bit of violence. It's got a bit of mad British sense of humour. It's old-fashioned. It's kind of a marvel, and it's weird. Like, Punch and Judy puppetry is just the weirdest thing. They got all kinds of weird gags like that involve... Punch and Judy involves sausages and crocodiles and babies and marmalade. And this at least involves babies, if not crocodiles and marmalade. So I think Punch is generally considered to look a bit like a jester. So that is the entertainer for me, is Punch from Punch and Judy. So that's my analogy to sum it all up, you know?
Yeah, I like it.
It's somewhere between Punch and Judy and Bruce Forsyth.
Oh god, if you say that to someone like without context, it would be a scary thing.
Yeah, so you know, that's our chat about The Court Jester, and with I've been drinking from the vessel with the pestle. Oh dear. And anyway, let's all raise a pestle with vessels and
I've got a chalice.
Let's all raise our vessels with pestles, chalices from the palaces, and dragons.
My flagon with a dragon.
Yes, thank you. Flagon with a dragon. And say a Merry Christmas, or whatever is appropriate, to the Court Jester.
Merry Jokemas.
Merry Jestermas.
Bye, everyone.
Ta-ta. Aww.